Good morning and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for June 13th, Monday, June 13th. We'll start with the weather. It says for today, record tying heat and humidity, high of 101 degrees. For tonight, mainly clear and breezy and very warm, high or low of 78. For Tuesday, breezy in the morning, hot in the afternoon, high of 91 and a low of 62. For Wednesday, a morning possible morning thunderstorm and mostly sunny, high of 77 and a low of 58. For Thursday, nice with plenty of sunshine, high of 87 and a low of 59. And then for Friday, plenty of sun, high of 88 and a low of 65. Sunrise this morning will be at 5:48, and sunset will be at 9:03 p.m. For tomorrow, Tuesday, sunrise will be at 5:48, and sunset will be at 9:04 p.m. Since we're discussing the weather, there is a warning story on the front page. It says heat index to hit 104 on Monday, heat advisory on from 1 to 9 p.m. Heat index values in the Sioux City area are expected to reach into the triple digits Monday afternoon. By around 2 p.m. Monday, heat index values are expected to hit 103 degrees, then will sit at around 104 degrees for about 3 hours, beginning around 3 p.m., according to the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls. The heat index isn't expected to go below 100 until around 8 p.m., Monday's actual high temperature, without taking relative humidity into account, is pegged at 98 degrees. The Sioux City area will be in a heat advisory from 1 to 9 p.m. Monday. During a heat advisory, residents are advised to drink plenty of fluids, stay in air conditioning, and check in on relatives and neighbors, according to the National Weather Service. Strenuous activities, if possible, should be conducted during the early morning or in the evening, and loose, lightweight clothing should be worn. Children and pets shouldn't be left unattended in a car for any period of time during a heat advisory. Temperatures aren't expected to improve much Tuesday, with a high temperature forecast at 93 degrees. Also on today's front page is a Sioux City City Council story, headlined $3.3 million project planned. Long vacant 5th Street building to be converted to new use. The Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to amend the urban renewal plan so that a developer can convert the long vacant former novelty machine building into residential units and commercial space. If approved, the amendment would also greenlight Lechner Lumber's construction of a new facility on the northeast corner of Floyd Boulevard and 4th Street. In order for the city to provide financial assistance for both projects, the council must approve a resolution adopting an amendment to the combined Central Sioux City CBD Urban Renewal Plan. The former novelty machine building at 901 5th Street has been vacant for nearly 20 years. According to documents filed with the city, an unnamed local developer has the property under contract and intends to convert the building into 25,000 square feet of residential space consisting of 21 residential units and 5,000 square feet of commercial space. The developer plans to invest more than $3.3 million in the project. The documents state city staff are working to finalize a development agreement which would provide property tax relief to the developer on the new incremental taxes created by the value added to the property for a period of up to 10 years. Financial assistance for the project from the city is estimated at approximately $750,000. Lechner Lumber, a full-service supplier of building materials for commercial and residential customers, plans to relocate its operations to the new facility at Floyd Boulevard and 4th Street. The company currently leases space at 200 South Court Street. The new location will include an office and two warehouse facilities with an entrance off 5th Street. The project represents a capital investment of $1.4 million. The company will retain all 9 employees, according to city documents. The other local front page story of interest is a salute to Lamar's Ice Cream Days Festival gets a revamp. And this is byline from Lamar's, obviously. On the stage of the Browns Century Theater, Shelley Brown was rehearsing a production number with her gospel singing children. Shelley, along with Adam, Andrew, and Michaela Brown, sang a rousing rendition of the Iowa Corn Song, written more than a century ago and covered by countless performers. The song, with lyrics like, "We're from Iowa, Iowa, that's where the tall corn grows," is part of an Oh My Iowa musical show the Browns will be performing at 1:30 p.m. Thursday and Friday at their 11 Central Avenue Northwest Theater. Shelley Brown said, "Oh My Iowa is not only our salute to Iowa, it also allows us to salute our hometown of Lamar's. We wanted to do the show especially for Ice Cream Days." Indeed, Ice Cream Days, which runs from Wednesday through Saturday, is a time when Lamar's, the home of Wells Enterprises Incorporated and Blue Bunny Ice Cream, can celebrate its status as ice cream capital of the world. Along with music from the Browns, the festival will also feature an ice cream social, free root beer float events, plus a cone hole exhibit, which is cornhole but with an ice cream twist. However, this year's Ice Cream Days will be very different than past festivals, according to Executive Planning Committee member Shannon Rodenberg. Rodenberg said, "For years, Ice Cream Days was a time for the community to come together for a celebration. This year, we've revamped the festival as a way to bring out of-towners to Lamar's." While such time-tested events like the Tri-State Cruisers Car Show, 5 p.m. Wednesday, Municipal Band Concerts, 7:30 Wednesday, and the Ice Cream Day Parade, 10 a.m. Saturday, will continue as usual. But Rodenberg is also excited about new activities like a carnival with midway rides, 3 to 9 p.m. Friday and noon to 7 p.m. Saturday, and even an ice cream-themed performance from the Omaha Arts Circus, 7:30 p.m. Friday. In addition, there will be daily scavenger hunts where visitors can spot historic highlights on downtown buildings and alley art exploration tours featuring public art displays and the large-scale murals on the alleyways of local businesses. Michaela Brown, who is also on the Ice Cream Days Executive Planning Committee, said, "We wanted to bring as much of Ice Cream Days to downtown Lamar's. This includes street performers, live artists, food vendors, merchant mart, and a kids zone in or near the Olson Cultural Events Center on South Northwest, First Street Northwest. With gas prices as high as they are, more people are sticking close to home," Rodenberg said. "That's why most of Ice Cream Day's events are either free or inexpensive enough for families, which will also include an outdoor Ice Cream Day's closing show concert featuring the Browns at 4 p.m. Saturday at the Olson Cultural Center. We'll be singing different types of songs, including many of our favorites," Shelley Brown said. "It will be a great way to cap off Ice Cream Days." And there is a very long list of events that run from Wednesday until Saturday. I don't think I want to read them all. And there doesn't seem to be any website link, but I'm pretty sure it will be on the internet somewhere if you are interested in a schedule. Moving on to another story with a local byline, there is Bruce Miller's review of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra concert. The headline says, "Harry Potter concert is more fun than a Quidditch game." You could really make a case for movie soundtracks as the classical music of today. At Saturday night's Sioux City Symphony Orchestra concert at the Tyson Event Center, the score for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone never sounded so lush. As with post-film orchestra combos, the SCSO played live while the film unfolded. A choir, too, added to the effect, making the series' first film seem classier than we remembered. The big screen added to the effect, and in case you weren't fully convinced, there were folks in Hogwarts robes and photo stations where you could feel like school was back in session. All the evening needed were a few Dementors flying overhead and the Sioux City Musketeers hoisting the Quidditch trophy. What helped the film were subtitles that let the audience know what the characters were saying. Because Potter World has its own vocabulary, it's often difficult. Plus, the Tyson acoustics aren't exactly designed for cinematic quiet moments. Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, though, were so fun to see as children. Sorcerer's Stone took on new meaning. It also helped lay the tracks for the films that followed. While some of the older actors are no longer alive, they certainly left an indelible impression and set this up for years of success. John Williams' score, meanwhile, was so filled with nuance you couldn't help realize he was responsible for much of their franchise's magic. The special effects may have been simple, but his themes were not. Add in the Missouri River Choral Society, and heck, you could have felt you were on vacation in Great Britain. Because Sorcerer's Stone runs well over 2 hours, it was great to have an intermission and, yes, concessions to make the journey go a little quicker. The three-headed dog, Harry's invisibility cloak, and that Quidditch game look a little elementary, in retrospect, but J.K. Rowling's storytelling holds up. She has a bit of Wizard of Oz in this book, and a Cinderella story that can't be denied. Williams' score set it apart. The strings got lots of opportunity to shine, and when director Christopher Columbus needed the emotions to swell, Williams more than delivered. Conductor Ryan Haskins wielded the baton like a wand, conjuring his own music in places we didn't remember. While there's definitely room for more film orchestra collaborations, this one was quite special. It made you want to see the real Hogwarts. And since the Universal theme parks have sections devoted to the films, it's just a matter of getting on a plane or a Nimbus 2000 and flying there. The State and Nation page features the other local-ish story. This one is bylined from Sioux Falls and is headlined Mixed Results for Governor Noem. 2/3 of South Dakota governor's favored candidates lose. Ahead of a potential presidential bid, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem handily won the Republican nomination last week for a second term. Many of the candidates she hoped to elect to the State House, however, did not have such a good night. She had hoped to replace contrarians with personal allies in the Republican-controlled legislature, which has consistently defied her wishes, so the governor rallied behind roughly a dozen candidates who challenged incumbents. 2/3 of Noem's favorites lost. The setback was a reminder that while endorsements often draw attention and financial resources, they do not always translate into support from voters. It's a lesson that Donald Trump, Noem's ally, is learning as he falls short, notably in Georgia, in trying to punish Republicans who have crossed him. In the GOP primary last month, Georgia voters overwhelmingly backed Governor Brian Kemp, who had rebuffed Trump's lies about widespread fraud during the 2020 election. Trump has tried to shake off his initial losses, but it is unclear whether Noem will be able to move forward so easily. Some incumbents who survived her efforts to defeat them are left wondering why a governor they support and generally agree with went to such lengths to try to oust them. State Senator Al Novstrup, a longtime lawmaker who perennially scores high on conservative organization scorecards, said, "There was a belief system that the party was a family. You do not campaign against other members. Obviously, that concept has broken dramatically in this primary." Noem entered the primary election with a somewhat strained relationship with Republican lawmakers. The results from the vote could only deepen the tension. Those tenuous bonds with the legislature could raise further questions about her ability to make a competitive bid for the Republican presidential nomination, as multiple contenders, including Trump, take steps to announce campaigns later this year. She spent most of her first term crafting a vision of South Dakota as an exemplar of conservative policy, tapping into activist fervor in what was widely seen as a play to be part of the White House conversation. But she also tempered her proposals with consideration for state government operations and the business community. That fueled conflict with some House Republicans in the legislature over proposals aimed at transgender children, exemptions to COVID-19 vaccine requirements, and tax cuts. Even though her party held 90% of the legislative seats, Noem's agenda foundered this year. House lawmakers hamstrung her proposals and often brushed aside her input. They even openly criticized her. One-third of the House Republican caucus voted for an unsuccessful effort to publicly scold Noem for taking a hands-on role in a state agency while it was evaluating her daughter's application for a real estate appraiser license. Among them was Republican Representative Fred Deutsch, who has mostly been supportive of the governor, but said he makes votes based on his conscience. He had also sparred with Noem before. His proposal in 2020 to bar puberty blockers and gender confirmation procedures to transgender children under 16 was rejected in the Senate after Noem expressed reservations about the proposal. As primary campaigns wrapped up in April, the governor publicly criticized Deutsch and put her support with a candidate she could trust, her childhood babysitter, Stephanie Sauder. But Noem's wishes in the primary race were only partially fulfilled in the contest, where two House candidates advanced from a field of four Republicans. Sauder received the most votes, but Deutsch beat out the two other candidates for the Republican nomination. Noem was able to see off one of her loudest Republican critics, House Speaker Spencer Gosch, as he challenged a state senator for the GOP nomination to that chamber. She also gained several other allies in the legislature, including a former chief of staff. Her decision to wade into the primaries did not go unnoticed by the grassroots groups animating the current divide in the state GOP. Noem received blowback from conservative media after a newspaper report that she was working with State Senator Lee Schoenbeck, the president pro tempore, to rid the state house of certain conservatives. Sensing trouble ahead, Noem tried to minimize damage and maintain her ties with conservatives. The effort included a private meeting in mid-May at a church in Sioux Falls with a group called Patriot Ripple Effect. Noem seemed eager to convince the dozens of people who filled a conference room at the church that she was like-minded. She pointed to her decision during the COVID-19 pandemic to forego statewide lockdowns and mask mandates, despite plenty of criticism and objections. She also clapped back at Republican lawmakers who pushed sweeping vaccine exemptions, espousing a hands-off approach to government that extends to businesses as much as individuals. Noem said, "They were blowing me up, saying I wasn't conservative because I would not come in and tell Sanford, the state's largest hospital system, and tell big businesses that they couldn't require vaccines for their employees. My answer for them was, you're telling me as the government to tell them, as a private business, what to do." Her assertions drew some applause, but their questions mostly challenged Noem, picking at her record throughout the 45-minute meeting. They wanted to know why she would target reliably conservative lawmakers. "My babysitter's running for office. I kind of like her," she responded. The group continued to press the question, with one member pointing to Noem's statement backing a challenger to Novstrup, the state senator. Noem's answer suggested her support for Rachel Dix was based more on personal connection than political ideology. "She's a friend of mine and has been for years," Noem said. As the primary results crystallized, it became clear the internal party conflict is not going away. Representative Tom Pischke, who is from the party's hardline conservative wing and easily beat Noem's pick for a state Senate seat, said he got a boost after being targeted by Noem's allies. a letter was even circulated among voters pointing out that Noem's preferred candidate, Lisa Rave, was married to the chief lobbyist for the state's hospital systems, a favorite target of certain conservatives during the pandemic. Pischke said that was the nail in the coffin for her. He added that the fallout from the race may have even spread to the governor's standing among ardent conservatives. It actually hurt Governor Noem a little bit, he said. Returning to the front page for the top story of the day, the headline says, Senate negotiators announce gun deal. Senate bargainers announced a bipartisan framework Sunday responding to last month's mass shootings, a noteworthy, though limited, breakthrough offering modest gun curbs and bolstered efforts to improve school safety and mental health programs. The proposal falls far short of tougher steps long sought by President Joe Biden and many Democrats. Even so, the accord was embraced by Biden, and enactment would signal a significant turnabout after years of gun massacres that have yielded little but stalemate in Congress. Biden said in a statement that the framework does not do everything that I think is needed, but it reflects important steps in the right direction and would be the most significant gun safety legislation to pass Congress in decades. Given the bipartisan support, there are no excuses for delay and no reason why it should not quickly move through the Senate and the House, Biden said. Leaders hope to push any agreement into law rapidly. They hope this month, before the political momentum fades that has been stirred by the recent mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. Participants caution that final details and legislative language remain to be completed, meaning fresh disputes and delays might emerge. In a consequential development, 20 senators, including 10 Republicans, released a statement calling for passage. That is potentially crucial because the biggest obstacle to enacting the measure is probably in the 50-50 Senate, where at least 10 GOP votes will be needed to attain the usual 60-vote threshold for approval. Families are scared, and it is our duty to come together and get something done that will help restore their sense of safety and security in their communities, the lawmakers said. The group, led by Senators Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, and John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, Tom Tillis, a Republican from North Carolina, and Kristen Sinema, a Democrat from Arizona, produced the agreement after two weeks of closed-door talks. The compromise would make the juvenile records of gun buyers under age 21 available when they undergo background checks. The suspect who killed 10 black people at a grocery store in Buffalo and 19 students and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde were both 18, and many perpetrators of recent years' mass shootings have been young. The agreement would offer money to states to enact and put in place red flag laws that make it easier to temporarily take guns from people considered potentially violent, plus funds to bolster school safety and mental health programs. Some people who informally sell guns for profit would be required to obtain federal dealer's licenses, which means they would have to conduct background checks of buyers. Convicted domestic abusers who do not live with a former partner, such as estranged ex-boyfriends, would be barred from buying firearms, and it would be a crime for a person to legally purchase a weapon for someone who would not qualify for ownership. Congressional aides said billions of dollars would be spent expanding the number of community mental health centers and suicide prevention programs, but they said some spending decisions are unresolved, as are final wording on juvenile records and other gun provisions that might prove contentious. Yet underscoring election year pressure from Buffalo and Uvalde, the parties shared desire to demonstrate a response to those shootings suggested momentum toward enactment was strong. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, called the accord a good first step to ending the persistent inaction to the gun violence epidemic, and said he would bring the completed measure to a vote as soon as possible. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, who has supported the talks, was more restrained. He praised the bargainer's work and said he is hoping for a deal that makes significant headway on key issues like mental health and school safety, respects the Second Amendment, earns broad support in the Senate, and makes a difference for our country. The agreement was quickly endorsed by groups that support gun restrictions, including Brady, Every Town for Gun Safety, and March for Our Lives, which organized rallies held around the country on Saturday. The National Rifle Association said in a statement that it opposes gun control and infringing on people's fundamental right to protect themselves and their loved ones, but supports strengthening school security, mental health, and law enforcement. The group has long exerted its sway with millions of firearms-owning voters to derail gun control drives in Congress. The agreement represents a lowest common denominator compromise on gun violence, not a complete sea change in Congress. Lawmakers have demonstrated a newfound desire to move ahead after saying their constituents have shown a heightened desire for congressional action since Buffalo and Uvalde, but Republicans still oppose more sweeping steps that Democrats want and Sunday's agreement omits. These include banning assault-style firearms such as the AR-15-style rifles used in Buffalo and Uvalde, or raising the legal age for buying them. AR-15s are popular and powerful semi-automatic weapons that can fire high-capacity magazines and have been used in many of the nation's highest-profile slaughters in recent years. One of them, the killing of 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, occurred 6 years ago Sunday. Democrats also wanted to ban high-capacity magazines and to expand required background checks to far more gun purchases. None of those proposals has a chance in Congress. Also on the Nation page is a story headlined, Abortion Foes See Path Through State Laws. The leaked draft of a majority Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade caught most of the nation by surprise, but anti-abortion legislation at the state level has been growing steadily over the past decade. Since 2009, nearly 400 abortion-related laws were passed, and 85% of them were aimed at restricting, regulating, or opposing access to the practice, according to a Bloomberg News analysis using data from LegisScan, a legislative tracking service. The bills included everything from sweeping abortion policy, shortening the amount of time to get the procedure, to more symbolic resolutions like memorials to fetal remains. Many of them weren't enforceable, while Roe was the law of the land, and were designed to signal anti-abortion leanings or directly challenge the Supreme Court ruling with the hopes of getting it overturned. As the Supreme Court shifted right, that emboldened state legislators who calculated the high court would be more favorable to unconstitutional laws. Supporters of abortion rights, meanwhile, are playing catch-up. Anti-abortion politicians' ultimate goal was to test the limits of the U.S. Supreme Court and see the day where we currently stand, the day when the Supreme Court would overturn Roe, said Jennifer Driver, Senior Director of Reproductive Rights at State Innovation Exchange, an advocacy group that works with state legislators on advancing reproductive health care access. The rampant pace in anti-abortion legislation picked up in the wake of the 2010 midterm elections in the middle of President Barack Obama's first term, which ushered in Tea Party politicians who were increasingly conservative, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. The number of restrictive laws has grown over time. A high watermark of 42 bills adopted in 2011 was surpassed in 2019 and 2021 when 50 or more were approved. In the past decade, 11 states have attempted to ban abortion at 6 weeks. Until recently, they never went into effect. But last year, SB 8 in Texas managed to get through a legal loophole by removing state enforcement. It includes a vigilante component that deputizes private citizens to bring civil lawsuits against anyone they suspect or know broke the law. In May, the most restrictive abortion law in the country took effect. In Oklahoma, it bans abortions at conception with few exceptions. The Supreme Court makeup shifted increasingly to the right with the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett in 2017, 18, and 2020, respectively. The Supreme Court is expected to make a decision on Roe at the end of June. State-level action to expand abortion access has moved at a slower clip and smaller volume. In all, there were fewer than 60 bills or resolutions passed since 2009 in support of abortion access. Those include prohibiting discrimination based on one's reproductive health decisions and protecting the privacy of abortion clinic workers. Half of those pro-abortion bills were passed in just four states, California with 16, Hawaii, New York, and Delaware, each with four or five. That delay can be attributed to the fact that some Democrat politicians have been relying on the courts to backstop political efforts against abortion access. Action from so-called haven states has ramped up ahead of the expected Supreme Court ruling. New Jersey and Colorado in recent months enacted laws that guaranteed the right to abortion. Maryland and California, which had already codified abortion access, this year put in place laws aimed at removing out-of-pocket expenses for the procedure. Those states are scrambling to protect reproductive choice, some to quickly enshrine the right to an abortion in state constitutions, and others taking measures to ensure sanctuary for those who cross state lines for care, said Noreen Farrell, executive director at Equal Rights Advocates, a gender justice advocacy group. Bloomberg News used the Legiscan API to access data on more than 1.5 million state bills or resolutions introduced since 2009, of which nearly 420,000 were successfully passed. The enacted bills were filtered to ones that included the following search terms in either the title or descriptive fields as provided by Legiscan. And then there's a list of words: abortion, feticide, abortifacient, mifepristone, misoprostol. Those are both medications to terminate a pregnancy. Unborn child, unborn infant, variations on terminating a pregnancy, including reproductive health, reproductive service, and reproductive decision. These terms include keywords suggested by Elizabeth Nash, a state policy analyst at the Guttmacher Institute. We're a little bit more than halfway through the reading of the journal for Monday, June 13th, and returning to the Nation page, there is a story headlined, "Search in Texas, Murder Case Finds Missing Child Now 42. This is bylined from Austin. A decades-long search by a Florida woman and her extended family linked to an unsolved murder case has resulted in the woman finally finding her missing granddaughter, now grown with no previous knowledge of her tragic history. Meanwhile, the mystery behind who brutally killed the girl's parents more than 40 years ago remains unsolved and has Texas authorities seeking the public's help. Harold Dean Klaus Jr., Tina Lynn Klaus, and their infant daughter had vanished in October of 1980, shortly after the young family moved from New Smyrna Beach, Florida, to the Dallas suburb of Lewisville, Texas, according to the Texas Attorney General's office. In January of 1981, in a rural area east of Houston, a dog that returned home with a decomposed human arm in its mouth prompted a police search that located the remains of an unidentified couple, the Houston Chronicle reported. The Harris County Medical Examiner's Office said the man had been beaten to death while the woman had been strangled. According to First Assistant Attorney General Brent Webster, the couple remained unidentified until last October when a group of genetic genealogists who worked with law enforcement tested the remains and identified them as the Klaus couple. However, no sign of the infant daughter, known then as Holly Marie Klaus, was found with her parents' remains. Webster did not answer questions during Thursday's news conference, but appealed for public help in solving the homicide cases. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who is running for re-election, did not attend. As for the missing infant, it wasn't until Tuesday, when modern technology led investigators into her workplace, that the now 42-year-old woman would learn of her biological family and her tragic background. Before that, all she knew was that she had been raised by an Oklahoma family who had adopted her. The child's adoptive family are not suspects in her disappearance or her parents' deaths, Webster said. He declined to provide their identities or how the child identifies herself today. Hours after the stunning revelation, the Oklahoma woman was introduced to her grandmother, aunts, and uncles during a Zoom call. She told them she had been married for more than 20 years and has 5 children and 2 infant grandchildren. But many questions remain, including who killed the Klauses. At some point, 2 women left the child at an Arizona church and took her into its care, Webster said. 2 women who identified themselves as members of a nomadic religious group brought the child to the church. They were wearing white robes and they were barefoot. They indicated the beliefs of their religion included the separation of male and female members, practicing vegetarian habits, and not using or wearing leather goods, Webster said. Move now to the world page for international stories. The first is headlined, Israeli Settlers at Risk of Losing Special West Bank Status. Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank may soon get a taste of the military rule that Palestinians have been living under for 55 years. If Israel's parliament does not act, a special legal status accorded to the settlers will expire at the end of the month, with wide-ranging consequences. Lawyers who live in the settlements, including 2 members of Israel's Supreme Court, will no longer be allowed to practice law. Settlers would be subject to military courts, usually reserved for Palestinians, and would lose access to some public services. While few expect things to reach that point, the looming deadline has put Israel's government on the brink of collapse and drawn dire warnings. Israel Gans, governor of the Benjamin Regional Council, said, "Without this law, it would be a disaster. The Israeli government will lose any control here, no police, no taxes." For over half a century, Israel has repeatedly renewed regulations that today extend a legal umbrella to nearly 500,000 settlers, but not to the more than 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank. After failing to pass on Monday, the bill will be brought for another vote in the Knesset this week in a last-ditch effort to save the governing coalition and the legal arrangement. The law underpins separate legal systems for Jews and Palestinians in the West Bank, a situation that 3 major human rights groups say amounts to apartheid. Israel rejects that allegation as an attack on its legitimacy. Jessica Montel, director of the Israeli human rights group Hamoked, said, "This is the piece of legislation that enables apartheid. The whole settlement enterprise depends on them enjoying all the rights and benefits of being Israelis, even though they are in an occupied territory." An overwhelming majority in the Knesset support maintaining the separate system. The main reason the bill didn't pass was that the nationalist opposition, which strongly supports it, paradoxically refused to vote in favor in an attempt to bring down Israel's broad-based but fragile coalition government. In a similar vein, anti-settlement lawmakers voted in favor of the legislation to keep the coalition afloat. Israel captured the West Bank in the 1967 Mideast War and has built more than 130 settlements there, many of which resemble small towns, with apartment blocks, shopping malls, and industrial zones. The Palestinians want the West Bank to form the main part of their future state. Most countries view the settlements as a violation of international law. Israel refers to the West Bank by its biblical name, Judea and Samaria, and considers it the heartland of the Jewish people. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett supports settlement expansion and is opposed to Palestinian statehood. Israel officially views the West Bank as disputed territory whose fate is subject to renegotiations, which collapsed more than a decade ago. The emergency regulations, first enacted in 1967 and regularly renewed, extend much of Israeli law to West Bank settlers, but not to the territory itself. Liron Libman, a research fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute, said, "Applying the law to the territory could be considered as annexing the territory, with all the political consequences that Israel did not want to have. Failure to renew the bill by the end of this month would have far-reaching consequences. The Israeli Bar Association requires lawyers and judges to reside in the country. Without the law's carve-out, settlers would not be able to practice law in Israeli courts. That would include two Supreme Court justices, one of whom recently upheld an order to forcibly relocate hundreds of Palestinians. The bill's lapse could also result in more settlers who run afoul of the law being tried in military courts, something Israel authorities have long tried to reserve for Palestinian subjects. The settlers could lose their ability to use national health insurance for treatment inside the West Bank and the ability to update their status in the population registry and get national ID cards, something routinely denied to Palestinians." On that same page is a story headlined, "Artist Confronts Anguish and Hope in War-Torn Ukraine." As Russian forces were advancing in Kyiv in late February, the Ukrainian military tried to stall them by blowing up a highway bridge just north of the capital. It may have helped, but it also slowed the exodus of civilians. For days, crowds fearing Russian artillery sheltered under the ruins of the bridge as snow swirled around them, and Ukrainian soldiers helped people, some with children or elderly or disabled citizens on their backs, traverse the icy Irpin River on a series of planks. Like millions of people across the globe, Roberto Marquez watched television coverage of the ordeal. Marquez said, "It really touched me," and he was in his native Mexico at the time. "I figured this is the place for me to work." And so Marquez, an artist who views his work as social advocacy, made his way to Poland and then to Kyiv. Once the Russians retreated from their positions around the city in late March, he set up a makeshift open-air studio in the shadow of the shattered bridge. With the blessing of Ukraine officials, he went to work there on a pair of large canvases. Outfitted in his 10-gallon leather hat and a bandolier holding his brushes, Marquez painted for more than a month as Ukrainian military foot patrols passed by daily on their rounds. He created two works, one 6 feet by 14 feet, the other 6 feet by 9 feet, both inspired by Pablo Picasso's Guernica. They depict a pair of signature early events of the war in Ukraine: the dramatic river crossing in Irpin, and the discovery of what Ukrainian officials are calling mass murder and war crimes in nearby Bucha and other towns that the Russians had occupied. With the help of Ukrainian friends, Marquez also crafted wooden crosses which he planted in the ground next to the rubble of the bridge to mark the escape path and honor the war dead. The idea came from the crosses placed by activists along the U.S.-Mexico border to commemorate migrants who died or disappeared there. Marquez, 60, said, "I'm a person of the border." He said he was 15 when he crossed the border illegally from Tijuana and went to work as an agricultural hand in California. As one of millions who acquired legal status through the 1986 U.S. amnesty law, he became a U.S. citizen. He later embarked on a lucrative real estate career in Dallas and had four children. Marquez turned to art as a sideline in the 1990s. Among his first works was a portrait of his mother as a young girl, painted at a time when she was gravely ill with cancer. "That was like opening the door to another world," Marquez said. His creative run turned to activism during the Trump era when caravans of Central American migrants began heading toward the U.S.-Mexico border. In Tijuana, he unveiled a huge variation of the U.S. flag, one that lacked stars and was meant to dramatize the contribution of immigrants. He called the work United States of Immigrants. He later created on-site artworks at Black Lives Matter rallies and other national protests. "I want to be exactly where the action is," he said. "That's where I get my inspiration." Once Marquez arrived in Poland in March, he started painting at the Warsaw train stations, a key transit point for refugees, and in the town of Medyka on the border with Ukraine. He stayed in Poland a few weeks, producing Cubist takes on the refugee influx. He left a handful of completed works behind, and though he is not sure what happened to all of them, he heard that some are now in the possession of Polish museum officials. In Ukraine, he set up shop next to the destroyed bridge with the support of the mayors of Irpin and neighboring Bucha, two Kyiv suburbs that are struggling to return to normal after the Russian invasion left widespread death and devastation. Marquez said he chose the Cubist Picasso motif because Guernica, which memorializes the Nazi bombing of the Basque town in Spain and is regarded as one of the great anti-war statements of all time, inevitably draws attention. The look is certainly derivative, but never obscure. For Marquez, the message may trump the aesthetic. "Every time I do a project, always the first thing that comes to mind is, what do I need to do to connect to people?" he explained. "I can do something in my own style, but sometimes you lose the audience. I can paint a Guernica with my eyes closed." With the Ukrainian flag fluttering overhead, the site has been transformed into a kind of outdoor art installation featuring Marquez's paintings, the rows of wooden crosses, and several handmade signs bearing messages of peace. Also on display is a collection of Russian military gear found abandoned at a nearby town. President Volodymyr Zelensky has announced plans for the construction of a national monument at the bridge commemorating all those who braved the journey. Marquez said he would be pleased if his paintings were incorporated into the final design. "I hope they leave them there as part of the memorial, but I don't know exactly," he said. "Whatever they do is fine by me." One last national story before concluding with Dear Abby. This is on the Nation and World page, headlined "Panel: There is enough to indict. Schiff says evidence would support charges against ex-president." Members of the House committee investigating the Capitol riot said Sunday they have uncovered enough evidence for the Justice Department to consider an unprecedented criminal indictment against former President Donald Trump for seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The committee announced that Trump's campaign manager, Bill Stepien, is among the witnesses scheduled to testify at a hearing Monday that focuses on Trump's efforts to spread lies about a stolen election. Stepien was subpoenaed for his public testimony. As the hearings unfold, Representative Adam Schiff said he would like the department to investigate any credible allegation of criminal activity on the part of Donald Trump. Schiff, from California, also leads the House Intelligence Committee that said, quote, "There are certain actions, parts of these different lines of effort to overturn the election that I don't see evidence the Justice Department is investigating." The committee launched its public hearings last week with members laying out their case against Trump to show how the defeated president relentlessly pushed his false claims of a rigged election despite multiple advisors telling him otherwise, and how he intensified an extraordinary scheme to overturn Joe Biden's victory. Additional evidence is set to be released in hearings this week that will demonstrate how Trump and some of his advisors engaged in a massive effort to spread misinformation, pressured the Justice Department to embrace his false claims and urged then Vice President Mike Pence to reject state electors and block the vote certification January 6, 2021. Stepien, a longtime Trump ally, is now a top campaign advisor to the Trump-endorsed House candidate in Wyoming's Republican primary, Harriet Hageman, who is challenging Representative Liz Cheney, the committee's vice chair and a critic of the former president. Monday's witness list also includes Vijay Pak, the top federal prosecutor in Atlanta, who left his position January 4, 2021, a day after an audio recording was made public in which Trump called him a never-Trumper. Chris Steerwalt, the former political editor for Fox News, noted Washington elections attorney Benjamin Ginsburg, and Al Schmidt, a former city commissioner in Philadelphia. All those are on the witness list. The panel will also focus on the millions of dollars Trump's team brought in fundraising in the run-up to January 6th, according to a committee aide who insisted on anonymity to discuss the details. The committee has said most of those interviewed in the investigation are coming forward voluntarily, although some have wanted subpoenas to appear in public. Committee members said they would present clear evidence that multiple GOP lawmakers, including Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, had sought a pardon from Trump, which would protect him from prosecution. Perry on Friday denied he ever did so. Adam Kinzinger, who's on the committee, said, "We're not going to make accusations or say things without proof of evidence or backing it up." The Dear Abby column is headlined today, "Boyfriend's True Colors Emerge After He Moves In." Dear Abby, I was married for 16 years and am finalizing the divorce. I decided to start dating again and found a really nice guy with a wonderful personality. I'm attracted to him, although I never thought I would love again. He's my age and has a kid. We talked for 6 months, after which he moved in. We have been living together for more than a year now. Things were perfect until I found out he has been talking sexually to other women online and met two women during our relationship. He insists they are just friends and nothing more. Now he's saying I'm not his girlfriend and never have been. What am I then? I asked one of his friends and they told me he is sexual with all women. He is just a playful guy. When I told him I knew he had kissed one of them, he said it was because he just wanted to know if anything was there. I have never done that to anyone. He lied about meeting the girls and about being on a dating site, and he's still sexting. I fell in love with him, but he doesn't say it back to me. Should we separate and just be friends or try to work on the relationship? He told me that his whole life women ghost him or go back to their exes. He has been hurt by a lot of them. I need advice. Signed, Let Down in Arkansas. And Abby responds, Dear Let Down, your roommate is not a nice guy. He's a player who hasn't been honest with you. Be glad his friend clued you in to what has really been going on while he has been living with you. Because you know he's a player, make an appointment with your doctor to be tested for STDs, then tell him the games are over and you want him out of your place immediately. You are too emotional right now to remain friends with him, and once you get your head on straight and recognize him for who he really is, you will no longer want to be. And the second letter begins, Dear Abby, my husband and I have been married for 2 years. He was married for 27 years to a woman who died 6 months before we met. He has an adult stepdaughter he raised and considers his daughter. He has biological children with whom I have a good relationship, and they like me. However, the stepdaughter doesn't like me at all, and she's very rude to me. His family invites her to family functions all the time. My husband keeps saying to give her a break because her mother died. I have never been anything but nice to her. My husband and I argue constantly about her. I have asked not to be around her. Is it rude of me not to go to his family function if she's going to be there? She makes it very uncomfortable for me. Signed, Bothered in Georgia. And Abby responds, Dear Bothered, Do not cut off your nose to spite your face. Go to the family functions, say hello to her, but after that, avoid her as much as possible. If she is overtly rude, call her on it. You do not have to tolerate being abused, and you should not be expected to. That concludes today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, June 13th. You can access a recording of today's reading and other readings of other newspapers on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.